Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Marcia Joyner, your host with Betrayed by Hospice, where we talk honestly about the reality of what hospice has become. Some of the information you hear on these shows may be repetitive, but it's important for those who do not know what is going on to hear the truth. While we all believe that hospice came to families to provide compassionate care for those people who were at the end of their natural life, hospice changed the rules. Today, March the 18th, marks a somber day as it is the 15th anniversary of Terry Schiavo's feeding tube being removed, sentencing her to a slow 13-day death by starvation and dehydration. Thousands of people watched the news to see if her parents would win the battle over her estranged husband who wanted her tube removed. Sadly, they lost that battle, and for the next 13 days, she suffered a terrible death. Her brother Bobby established the Terry Schiavo Life and Hope Network, which will commemorate the final days of his sister's inhumane death over the next 13 days. This is not only to remember her, but also draw attention to the countless people who are suffering slow, agonizing deaths in hospices, nursing homes, and hospitals in America and around the world. Perhaps one day a difference will be made, but I won't hold my breath. But I will continue to warn people of the injustices done to the most vulnerable people, infants, elderly, and those with disabilities. We should be using all means to protect our people. Hospice was originally created in 1967 by Cicely Saunders to provide comfort and help the actively dying minimize pain and cross over peacefully. It was for people who were admitted because they had a terminal illness like end-stage cancer or liver or kidney failure that could no longer be treated with medications. Let me quickly explain the difference between hospice and palliative care. The purpose of both is to provide comfort, but palliative care can begin with the diagnosis and along with treatment, while hospice care begins after treatment of the disease is stopped when it is clear that the person is not going to survive the illness. However, that is not what is happening today. Over the years, the criteria for admission became more lax to allow more people to be certified. People who could be successfully treated with medication for illnesses, such as congestive heart failure, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, better known as COPD, and dementia. Then that criteria was further watered down to add people who went to the hospital too many times for broken bones, breathing issues, dehydration, or anemia. Going to the hospital 3 or 4 times is often referred to as a frequent flyer, and it can get you flagged before you leave the hospital. Someone comes in to talk to you about enrolling you or your loved one into hospice because they want to help. They want to make your life easier by coming to you. Don't fall victim to this. Fast forward to now, where a person can qualify with something as simple as losing the ability to dress or feed themselves or because they're incontinent. All of this happened while people just nodded their heads and accepted the criteria scope creeping and thought nothing of it because we trust medical professionals to make prudent decisions for us, right? Or because they are good at selling the features. And after all, it's a free service for care because you're not told the truth when they manipulate you to enroll you. And after all, isn't hospice compassionate? It isn't. Hospice has become a very profitable business, which is why so many want in on the action. You don't even have to have medical knowledge to buy a facility where hospice patients will be taken for their final days, euthanasia. It saves the government money because they don't have to treat the patient for issues. They don't have to run tests, perform procedures such as kidney dialysis for patients that they deem not viable to society. These people are no different than in the Holocaust, where they were called useless feeders. They can euthanize patients with drugs such as morphine, Ativan, Haldol, Seroquel, fentanyl, which causes starvation and dehydration and ultimately a horrible death, but it's much cheaper than treating them. And it happens not because the patient is actively dying when they enrolled or that they really believed they would die naturally in 6 months. No, because hospice can hurry that process along with the drugs and they get paid for it. It's all about the money. Greedy people making it, the government saving it, while the patient and their family pay the ultimate sacrifice. And just when you think you're safe from hearing more about the coronavirus, I'll be brief, but I wanted to say that I find it hypocritical or ignorant that people seem to be outraged by the fact that recently 25 elderly died from the virus in nursing homes in Washington State. Where is the outrage about elderly being murdered by hospice staff daily in all states for years? There are no statistics for these because the certificates state fictitious reasons, lies to cover the crime. We need those statistics and we need to expose these crimes. In 2020, the aggregate cap that Medicare or Medicaid would pay per patient is $29,964.78, which is approximately 6 months of care for one individual. There are different levels of care which are paid for at different daily rates. This cap is based on the number of patients times the amount of money. So someone could be in the hospital for 10 days, in hospice care, for 10 days, 1 month, 3 months, or 10 months. Hospice does not receive payment after the patient dies. So if they came in and only lived 15 days, they get 15 days of pay, not for the entire month or not for 6 months. The money that one patient doesn't use could be used for another patient. So again, it's the amount of patients times the funding. I always try to point out in my talk shows that all hospices are not bad. All hospices don't hasten people's deaths, but many do, and you need to be aware of the dangers, the red flags, and what your rights are. It is the day for everyone to wake up and realize it's no longer an organization that deserves our blind trust. You must verify everything and stay with the patient, especially at night, and be aware of deception and drugs. They are taught how to successfully convince the family with their lies. And a note on the drugs, although I won't go into any details tonight on this, not all of the drugs being used are bad. Some have positive outcomes in the proper amount, duration, and circumstances. But hospice is using all of these drugs as a one-size-fits-all, and they are overdosing patients. That is the problem, is not the only option to care for your loved one. Sometimes people can't have their loved one at their house and take care of them. I get that. But there are other options. You can go to different links like payingforseniorcare.com, or Medicare.gov and look up home health services, or AARP.org and, again, look up home care. There are other places. you have a right to refuse hospice and use one of these other alternatives. You have a right to be a part of the plan and agree or disagree with part of it or the whole plan. You have a right to revoke hospice at any time and remove your family member. You or your family should never be given drugs that you do not consent to and you don't know what the drugs are going to do. Ask questions. Google the medication. No means no, and it is your right. You must be aware, and you have to be strong. And if you can't be strong, call for backup. Which brings me to a durable medical power of attorney. Everybody needs to have one of those drawn up with someone listed that you trust to speak for you in the event that you're incapacitated. It needs to be someone who will follow your wishes and who does not want you gone because they can benefit from your demise. I've heard so many cases where siblings decide to engage in their mom or their dad's demise to get the inheritance, and another sibling wants their parent to live, but the parent either didn't have in a power of attorney drawn up or they had the wrong person listed and they lost the battle. It doesn't have to be the oldest child that's given the authority. It doesn't even have to be the child. It's who you trust to make the best, unselfish decision for you in the event you cannot make your own decisions. If you don't have anybody to make this decision for you and you don't have a document drawn up, the doctor makes the decision or your nurse there makes the decision. Don't wait until you're in a hospital or a situation where you need this document and don't have it. You need it now before you're incapacitated. HaloVoice.org, that's H-A-L-O, voice, together, .org, has sample advance directives for health care listed by state. Our mom was a victim of this betrayal in Georgia in 2017. She had congestive heart failure that was being successfully treated with medication, and she had a bad hip that didn't have cartilage, which did cause her pain. After a visit to the hospital for anemia, we were approached and told that she met hospice criteria because of the congestive heart failure, and if we enrolled her, they could come to the house and take her vitals so she didn't have to get in and out of the car with her hip. They could help Dad with caregiving, and they could even bring meals. And we thought, what a great organization. And since our dad had previously been the hospice chaplain at that facility for 15 years, we believed our mom was safe, but still asked the question. Because we've heard, you know, hospice, you go into hospice, it's because you have 6 months and you're going to die. And we didn't want that. So we asked, you won't hasten her death, right? Oh, we don't do that. They seemed insulted that we even asked it, but we asked the question. Little did we know, it didn't matter that we asked the question. They lied. They said they wouldn't prolong her life with heroic efforts, and we were never to call 911. We agreed, and ultimately it would cost Mom her precious life. In June of 2017, she and Dad were tricked into going to the hospice respite facility for Dad to receive rest, and they immediately started drugging Mom with morphine, Ativan, and 100 micrograms of fentanyl. It put her in a coma, and she died 10 days later from the drugs and the dehydration in a cruel death in spite of our efforts to take her to the hospital and save her. We were stopped at every turn we tried to make. They constantly lied to us. Any healthy person given the same drugs that she was given, the combination and the duration, would have died. So no, it wasn't my mom's time to die. She was euthanized, or plainly stated, my mom was murdered by hospice. So that's why I do these shows. That's why it's my passion to spread the word that hospice is a dangerous avenue in most cases. It is called stealth euthanasia, as cited on hospicepatients.org, because it's done in the open, right in front of us, and we have not a clue until it's too late. We're little sheep being led to the slaughter, believing everything they say. You need to be aware of the dangers. Do your research and know what may happen if you blindly trust like we did. I belong to a Facebook group called Murdered by Hospice. Several of our new members, I think it's four or either five, have read our stories, and they made a conscious decision not to enroll their loved one into hospice. So we are reaching people. We are saving people from a hastened, cruel death. One of the most recent success stories is Renee Haley's mom, Donna Hathorne, 82 years young, who peacefully died in her own natural time on March the 9th, without strong drugs hastening her death. Renee had read the members' horror stories and decided not to enroll her mom, in spite of the pressures from the medical staff and others to do so. She, and more importantly, her mom, are blessed because she didn't. Some time ago, I talked to you about a situation with Dr. William Hussle in Mount Carmel Hospital, Columbus, Ohio. The most recent information, he is charged with killing 25 patients with greater than 500 micrograms of fentanyl, and they died soon after the doses. Last week, there was more information on this. The hospital was fined $400,000 for violating pharmacy laws and $77,000 charged for the investigation. Hussle has pleaded not guilty, stating he was helping his patients. The hospital is now closed, but the operational license has been transferred to Grove City Hospital. Two pharmacists were fined $2,000 and $1,000 and have to receive additional training in palliative care and pain management, which is interesting because there is an act called the Pachetta Act that they're going to try again to push through, which is going to create more hospices, and they call it the Palliative Education and Training Act. So here we have pharmacists that had to have known that these strong doses of fentanyl were being used rather quickly while this doctor was killing people. So to me, just a fine of $2,000 and $1,000, really, people died from this. 23 nurses were fired. 25 are facing administrative hearings. The hospital paid $13 million to the families of the patients. Hussle is suing for defamation of character and wrongful termination. His trial is set for June 2020 for these murders. I can't wait to see him sent to jail for the rest of his life. I don't know if Ohio has a death penalty or not. I need to find that out. Before I make this statement, let me clarify. If you have terminal cancer or a disease that truly can no longer be treated, and you know your time is near and you are in pain and suffering, your decisions have to be based upon your own circumstances. If you know doing CPR or any heroic effort will not add value to the time you have left, then you may definitely need a do not resuscitate in place. But be aware of your particular circumstances. If you do have a DNR, they will treat nothing, and they will not focus on keeping you alive, even if you had 6 months or 3 years of time left. They just won't. Knowledge is power. Do your research and make informed decisions. Don't let someone who doesn't care about you as a person make your life decisions and be caught, as my family and hundreds of others were, wondering what happened as our precious mom took her last breath. Living with these memories and visions is something you can never undo or never unsee. Another clarification that I need to make is assisted suicide is not the same as stealth euthanasia. Assisted suicide, or often referred to as medical aid in dying, is where a person goes to the doctor and requests drugs and they have to administer them to themselves, and it causes death. euthanasia is done to a person against their consent or knowledge. There is a big difference in that, although the results are the same. There are 11 states in the United States now that have assisted suicide. And Marty, if you're listening, can you tell me again what they call it in Australia? Okay, I'll ask for that later. Australia is having the same problem, but they call it something different. Tonight, many of you who listened to the previous show on March the 4th are already aware of our guest speaker, Michelle Young Duers. This is part two, since we didn't have time for her to share all of her journey with us. So, a recap for those who may not know who Michelle is. She is a registered respiratory nurse and a certified respiratory therapy technician with the National Board of Respiratory Care. She served as a clinic instructor in a local college for 2 years and received Employees Recognition Award from the medical staff of a university hospital for dedication to patient excellence. She served 5 years on the ethics board of 4 major hospitals in Tampa Bay Area. Michelle has been involved in healthcare since the 80s, and when her dad passed in 2010, he was under hospice care, and there seemed to be no issues. Her mom was pleased with the services because someone would call her each month for grief support and ask her how she was doing, and this went on for a year. So when Michelle saw that there was an opening for a respiratory therapist in hospice, and under the circumstances, her mom had a good situation with that, she went ahead and applied for the position. Each manager that she met with and talked with asked her why she decided to come to hospice for a position. And she recounted what had happened after her dad's death and how nice and thoughtful they were to call her mom. At the final interview, when she talked to the manager and said that, the manager looked at her seriously and said, "You do realize we make those calls because we have to and not because we want to." This would be the first crack in the shell that she would come to see. She would learn a lot more about the reality over the next few years as she would slowly be allowed in the inner circle of hospice nurses. Michelle was a hospice nurse for 7 years when she eventually could no longer be a part to what was occurring. Michelle's latest accomplishment is her book titled Killing for Profit: The Dark Side of Hospice. Her book gives an entrenched view of what happens in the heart of hospice with patients and staff. I was aware that people were being drugged into an early death, but I wasn't aware of other issues that she uncovers that we all should be aware of. She shares specific patient stories that expose mistakes made, broken promises, wrong people making medical decisions, and the unwillingness to really help a family at the most crucial time of their life. Compassion? Yeah, I don't think so. There was no sense of urgency with the staff, a disregard for doing what is best for the patient, and a total lack of empathy. It exposes that profit is the end game and not meeting the needs of a dying patient. She also provides an insight into medical terminology specifically related to oxygen that most of us are clueless about. Michelle has a true compassion for her patients as well as their pets and rescued many during her tenure. She puts the needs of their patient before anything else, which ultimately cost her her position. But she's okay with that because she could no longer stand by and watch what was happening. She exposed the truth then, and she exposes it now in her book, which can be purchased on Amazon. During the previous show, she shared some of her stories with us that we don't have the time to go over in detail, so I encourage you to listen to the archive show or purchase her book. If we have time at the end, we might go over a few of them. And I know I've talked way too much. Thank you, Michelle, for agreeing to come back with us and continue our discussion about your tenure in hospice and exposing the truth with our listeners. Some of the information that you're going to be giving is redundant, but in case someone didn't hear it before or in case we need a refresher, I'd like for you to go over just a couple of those things. So I'll let you start by telling us anything about yourself or your time there that you want to before we go into questions. Michelle? Michelle? Did I lose everybody? Marty? I don't know if I have my listeners on either. Okay, this thing says we're rolling, but
what's going on here?
I don't have. Did I lose Michelle?
She just muted up. Hang on a second here.
No.
Okay.
Hello.
Are you there,
yeah,
Michelle?
There you go.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Hear you.
There you go.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
I feel
thank
like you're going to
keep on talking then, but they'd rather hear you than me.
Okay,
Michelle, it's all yours.
Well, thank you for having me on again, Marcia, and thank you for all what you do for the community. Just briefly about myself, I think I'd rather talk about my mom, if you don't mind.
That's fine.
In order to know me, you have to know my mom, who grew up in England in 1946. She was 15, and she tried to get into nursing school, and they wouldn't allow her into the infirmary until she was 17. And she would go over and over again to the infirmary, and finally, at the age of 16 and a half, they allowed my mom to help the other nurses, and then at 17, they allowed her to enter the nursing program. My mom turns 89 on Friday, this Friday.
Happy birthday, yeah. Mom.
Right. And then shortly after the war, she moved to America. She was hired by a surgeon to be a scrub nurse. She worked in his office, made rounds with him at the hospital, and scrubbed in to surgery with him to be his assistant. And then during our childhood, you know, we had all kinds of animals in coming and going. My mom was the neighborhood nurse for every bump and scratch, animal and kid alike. So, you know, when you look at my mom's determination to be a nurse and that she excelled and her love of animals, I mean, the apple, that saying the apple doesn't fall far from the tree is exactly who I am, and I think the world of my mom just as you do yours. Moms are special.
Well, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And your mom should be very proud of the lady that you have become in helping people and standing true to your position and Hippocratic Oath. So we need more nurses like you.
Thank you.
So with the hospice process, some of our people may not know what is entailed. I talked a little bit about the criteria, but what actually happens? So, like, if you're in the hospital and someone comes visit you, can you kind of take through the process at that point?
The admission process to hospice?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So when you're in the hospital and your Medicare benefits have expired or the benefit period, or you're costing the hospital more to treat than they're being reimbursed for. And last show I mentioned, you know, the hospitals get paid so much per day. Well, that per day, what I meant was they get a bulk, they may get a bulk amount of money, and then it's divided up by the days of how much your length of stay in the facility. So when a patient starts costing the hospital more than they're making the hospital, because the hospital is there not only to treat, but they're there to make money, they will enlist hospice. And it's a con- complicated. If you're an outsider trying to look at this, it can be so confusing, and they know that, and they will use it against you, hospice and the hospital together, that the referral will come from either the case manager. When you're admitted to a hospital, there's a case manager assigned to you, regardless of what you're there for or your financial status. Case manager is assigned to you. And that case manager knows everything about you, why you're there, how long you should be there, what the payer, your insurance or Medicare is going to reimburse the facility for the services that they're rendering to that patient. They have all those numbers. So when you start cutting into their profit, that case manager will either approach the patient or the family or the physician for a hospice referral. Now, I'm not talking about if you're in there for surgery and the surgery's fine and you have an extra day there because, you know, maybe you spiked the temp or something. That's different. I'm talking like chronic illnesses, those type things.
Well, like what I was talking about earlier, if you keep coming back in because you can't breathe or you're anemia or, you know, you have COPD or you broke a bone, it's those people that are keep coming back in, right, that's part of them that are considered frequent flyers that you're starting to cost money because you keep coming to the hospital all the time because you're getting older.
Exactly. And unfortunately, for, say, our COPD patients, if they pick up a little cold, a little flu, and they end up in the ER, that's not their fault. I mean, their immune system is already going to be compromised. You can give them, you know, some extra fluids, give them a few antibiotics, give them a couple of days, and for the most part, you know, they should rebound. But they're going to go back to the hospital several times a year. It's that the hospital doesn't like are those readmission type patients.
Right.
Because it looks bad on the hospital and it looks bad on the physician because the way the insurance companies look at it, if you're treating your patient appropriately, then the patient shouldn't be coming into the hospital so often. That's not fair, really. That may look good on paper somewhere, but in reality, that's not how it works. So these are bad, in quotation marks, bad marks against a hospital or a physician. And here's the thing. Physicians are contracted by insurance companies. They basically work for insurance companies. So when you say go Google a physician that you want to go visit and they list 15 different insurance companies they take, you know who they're working for? The insurance companies. So the insurance companies are going to tell them, well, we're only going to reimburse you this amount and your patients need to have their flu shot. That's the other thing. They put these, you know, the patient has to have a BMI of so much or so less, and then did they get their flu shot? And there's all these check boxes that the doctor's required by the insurance companies to complete. So they've become...
Yeah, can you speak up just a little bit?
I'm sorry.
A little bit louder.
So they actually become... Is that better?
Yes.
So they actually become an employee of the insurance company. So getting back to the hospital with hospice.
Now, is that just at the hospital or is that in a doctor's office too? Or is it just in a hospital?
No, that's in a doctor's office as well.
Okay, so like if you go to, you know, like a PPO or, you know, if you go to Kaiser, you know that all of the doctors in Kaiser are Kaiser doctors, right? And that's
right.
The insurance. But if you go to just a general practitioner doctor, he's not with a specific insurance company, or are you saying he is?
He's not with a specific insurance company, but he gets his payments from an insurance company. And there are guidelines that insurance company puts on the physician that the physicians have to follow. And in turn, the physicians also have to try and get their patients to follow these guidelines so they're reimbursed appropriately.
Okay, so for an example, like flu shots, and I'm just asking this question, we're kind of off subject, but like a flu shot, when you come into the doctor's office, they want to give you a flu shot, and if you refuse to take the flu shot, then they get sort of dinged for it or something because, you know, every doctor should be forcing everybody to take vaccines, right?
Correct.
Because if
now
you
they
don't...
So if you don't, they will make a note in your chart that they did offer and you declined. But the next time you're in that office, they have to show where they offered and declined, offering declined. So they'll keep until you either do it or, you know, it just goes on for infinity. They're not doing that for their purpose. They're doing that for the insurance company's purpose. Do you follow
okay.
me?
Yeah.
So... And these days, and again, I'm getting all sidetracked, but I just want to say this one thing. There are more and more physicians that are working independently, that they don't take money from insurance companies, that they do charge you more to go there. There's a physician here locally that it's $1,500 a year to be her patient, and then you pay so much per visit. But her whole goal, then she's working directly for you. She's not obliged to do anything for insurance companies because she's not taking any insurance money. Do you follow me? So there's there's going to be a big difference in the care that you receive. So getting
okay.
back to the hospital.
Okay.
So once they've identified a patient, the case manager will visit the patient, give them a little overview of what hospice is, but they may kind of precede that with what your options are, but they're going to be limited options, like, you know, your finances are this, if you want to go to a nursing home, you know, you probably used all your benefit days, it's going to cost you so much out of pocket. The hospital, and this is a generalized statement, and it's not against every hospital, but it is becoming the norm. Hospitals would much rather put a patient that they see as abusing the system into hospice than into any other kind of, like, nursing home, ALF. Because if you are put into a nursing home or ALF or sent home with home care, where you're going to end up back in their ER. That's not where they want you. They want you over in hospice because then they, for the most part, they're done with you and they don't have that fear of you coming back. Does that make any sense?
Wow. Yeah, exactly. It does. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then once that the case manager for the hospital has laid that groundwork, then there's a hospital liaison person. She comes in and educates the patient, basically saying the same things to case manager. They all read from the same book. They just word it a little differently. And the hospice liaison will come in and find out what's most important for that patient. Is it medication? Is it getting help in the home? What is it? They will emphasize those services. If the patient's worried about getting their meds at home, oh, we'll take care of it. We'll cover all your meds. We'll have them delivered. You won't have to pay anything. We'll take care of all that. They also look into what is the patient afraid of. So then they also use that to, again, emphasize the services that they have available to that patient. So now once they've sold the patient on this, there's an admission nurse that will come in, kind of, again, go over everything and have them sign on the dotted line. What they're not told, and we're things are kind of left unsaid, questions unanswered. Is that, yes, medications are covered under hospice, but maybe not that specific drug. So, you know what, you don't need that medication anymore. And now that I say that, I'm going to relay a little story about a pediatric patient. We had a pediatric patient coming into service, same scenario, out of a hospital, chronic illness, and I was on the conference call because it was a pediatric patient. We have a conference call, and the pediatrician for hospice, as the nurse is going over the medication, the pediatrician was designated them as, okay, he can keep that one, it's cheap. No, he can't have that one, it's too expensive. Not does he need it, how long has he been taking it, what's his response to it, is it helping him? Any of those other questions you would really want to know to evaluate whether a medication you want to discontinue or not. The medications on this pediatric patient were basically categorized into two, cheap or too expensive. That is a prime example of how hospice will manipulate your medications to whether you need them or not. So now when you get home, these promises that were made are, you know, that pie in the sky type, oh, we'll take care of everything, is now a reality of it's not as good as they sold you on. And when the patient complains, there's so much information to take in such a short amount of time. And the patient and the family are already overwhelmed with the situation, the illness, all of these factors, and they're trying to keep track of who said what, where, when, and you've got three people coming into the room telling them all different things, and they can't keep track of it. Well, there's no reason, you know, there's a reason they don't want them to keep track of it, because then they can say anything.
Yeah. Right. So basically they just manipulate them and they say what the patient wants to hear so that they can get them to sign on the dotted line.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And then they take them in, and then they're, you know, they determine what your life is going to be, because the problem is you got into a system that you were manipulated into, and now that you're in it, you don't think you have a way out. And as the family, we don't know this, and we just assume, well, we're in there, there's nothing we can do. That's not true. You can revoke hospice at any time. Any time.
Exactly.
And they don't want you to go into, like you said, a home health care or assisted living, because then there's a chance you might break a bone, or you might have, you know, COPD that kicks back up and you have to come back to the hospital. They don't want to readmit you to the hospital. So
correct.
I hope that was clear to all of our listeners, because that's very important, the manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so
exactly
I want
it
to, it is, it's a total manipulation. I'd like to move on and talk about how the system fails patients who may be on the books too long, as the case with Miss Minnie.
Miss Minnie, she was such a doll baby. She was a hospice patient before I even started with hospice. I think she had been with them about a year when I started with hospice and I started seeing her. And I came to know Miss Minnie, that she loved vanilla ice cream, which every once in a while I would stop by an ice cream shop and bring her some ice cream. And the strange thing about it is I first would stop at these like little yogurt places and bring her vanilla yogurt. You know, her favorite was actually, and I don't condone this, I'm just saying it, she loved McDonald's vanilla ice cream. Okay. I'm bringing McDonald's. That wouldn't be my choice, but okay, whatever you want, it would be.
That's
loved
cute.
She she wouldn't let anybody visit her on Tuesdays and Thursdays because those were her days. And she would also, she was, honestly, when I started visiting her, I wondered why she was even in hospice. She was still going out to lunch, you know, once a week with the other ladies. She didn't need any oxygen. She didn't need a walker. She needed, I don't think we were supplying her any medications at the time. And I, you know, still continued to go out and evaluate her and see if there was anything we could be doing for her. Well, over the years, she did decline. I mean, she had COPD, and she did start to decline. And by the fourth year, she was starting to be to where she needed a low-flow oxygen, 2 liters of oxygen. She needed some breathing treatment. She needed some other medications. And she was starting to decline. She was no longer able to go out with her lady friends for lunch. The medications that were mailed to her would sit on her doorstep until, you know, someone visited to bring her medications in. And then towards the last couple of visits, she would just leave her front door unlocked because she was too weak to even get up and answer the door. So towards the end of her stay with hospice, she became, you know, very weak to the point where she genuinely needed hospice, and now she is a hospice patient. I mean, this is the type of person that if you admitted her to hospice, you would say, yes, she's hospice appropriate. However, the problem is, she had been in hospice so long that they were making really nice money on her because hospice wasn't doing anything for her. They didn't have to supply her with any DME equipment, any medications, any of that stuff. But now towards the end, when she needed hospice, they wanted her off the books to where they now she had to go into another hospice. And someone would say, well, why would they get rid of her? Well, because now they're losing money on her and she's been in hospice too long. And there was another hospice that was a new hospice in the area that wanted the admissions. So the one hospice discharged her and the other hospice picked her up. Now, some would say, okay, well, she still has hospice. No, it's not okay. She's come to know her caregivers over the years, trusted them. She had her stuff in place by this time. And now you're going to have her go through the discharge process and then picking up equipment and everything of a transferring over from one company to another company. There was no thought given to that patient, Miss Minnie.
And it's brand new people. It's
right.
Brand new people that she doesn't know, and it's at a time when she needs friends. She needs people who understand her and who knew her as a vibrant lady who did all these things. You know, she's made a rapport with y'all. So, yeah, I think that's terribly cruel. I know that with my mom, they kept changing the person that would come out to the aid, and it was constantly changing where it would be a different person each time. And that stressed her. And she even told them towards the end, you know, just don't send anybody. I'm tired of you sending somebody new every single week. I don't know these people. And they're coming in your home, maybe giving you a bath. And, you know, it's uncomfortable to have strangers in.
And every aide has their way of doing something. And the patient gets used to one particular aide and gets comfortable. And they become a friend, which makes a difference.
Absolutely.
If you can keep that one aide. I will tell you another side note. They will promise you, an aide will visit 2 or 3 times a week, give you a bath. Okay. Just like the chaplain who I kept asking, you know, patients, do you want to see a chaplain, And so, well, we asked for one, but we're told he's on vacation. And then when I finally said, where's the chaplain, to one of the nurse managers, oh, we don't have one. I said, well, why are you telling them patients that he's on vacation? Well, we can't tell them we don't have one. Okay, well, the same thing with the AIDS. You're going to be told you can get a bath 2 or 3 times a week, but when there's one aid, and I'm not exaggerating, when there's one aid to cover a county for patients, you know, you'll be lucky to get a bath once every 2 weeks from that aid. Those aids are stretched beyond, you know, too much.
Right. And that's one of the things that they told you to get you to enroll, all of these wonderful things from this candy shop, mm-hmm. and then, no, maybe once every week or once every 2 weeks, they might have an aide that can come in to give you a bath.
Mm-hmm.
And again, to the listeners, this is not all hospices. It's what I've experienced. It's, you know, what Michelle's telling you, and it's what a mm-hmm. lot of people I know have experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, broken promises.
And if I may say so, the hospice I worked for was a corporate office. I worked for the corporate office. They owned one hospice in one county, and they owned another hospice that covered 3 counties. Then they ended up buying another hospice that covered 2 counties. So, no, 3 counties, I'm sorry. So it was a total of 7 counties. So not only did I have the experience of those 3 hospices, but it's also the interaction at the hospital with the other hospice companies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you follow me?
Yes, and absolutely.
And some of these hospices, they have a monopoly in a county. So they may be the only hospice available, and they can have that we'll take it or leave it attitude. And unfortunately, that's a bad thing. I've been trying to fight to get the certificate of needs taken away. Right now, if there's a new hospice that wants to come into the area, they have to prove there's a need and be given a certificate of need. And that's not the way it is. That's not the way it should be. It should be a free open market for whoever wants to provide hospice services, you provide them, not just allow one company to rule a whole area and do what they want. That doesn't work
that
way.
No, because then if you have, you know, like a small entity that wants to come in and be a pro-life hospice,
mm-hmm.
they're going to keep them out because that's
mm-hmm.
where people would want to go, to that particular pro-life facility. So,
correct.
Yeah, they don't want that competition.
No.
Of course not.
No.
So, okay, so Miss Millie was in the system too long, and I don't know why they had her in there to begin with, but they did.
Money.
But then in the end run, she was the one that, you know, had to pay the price. Because now she's got new people when she really, really needed somebody. So,
right.
And you would only visit her maybe once every 2 weeks. So I want everybody to understand it's not like she had somebody in there 3 or 4 times a week. Because if that were the case, she would have run out of money. So that she only got a nurse in there, like, you know, once every 2 weeks they'd come in. As Michelle has said, she didn't have any needs initially. And as as she got COPD and progressed, then her needs became more.
Correct.
So, okay.
Correct.
So, Mr. L, let's talk about Mr. L. I want to point out the times in life when they talk about how compassionate people in hospice are. In the most critical time when you want somebody to be there for you and to help you with certain things, you should be able to count on them because this is what they've said they'll do. And in the case of Mr. L, that's not what happened. with the road trip he wanted to take. So can you talk about that?
Sure. Mr. L, now, this is one of those other longer stories that I'm going to have to give the Reader's Digest version of, but I'll encompass it. Mr. L and his wife were snowbirds, came down to Florida, lived in one of these, you know, mobile home, seasonal type.
RV.
Right. Residence. And I was sent out to see him because the nurse had turned up his oxygen and she wanted to know how far she could go up and stuff like that. So I went out and saw, visited him. And he was sitting on the side of his bed, barely able to breathe. And I looked over his medicine. Well, first I started a breathing treatment on him to get him going a little bit. And I turned his oxygen up a little bit. And I looked over his records. And he was being treated as a COPD patient. When once I looked at everything and evaluated him, he really had interstitial lung disease. And there's a, you know, there's a difference between that. I don't know that we want to get into that right at this moment, but so.
Well, just the treatment is different for the two diseases, correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
It's different,
right.
And the education you need to give the patient and how they do things is completely different. Anyways, his goal was to go back home, where all his family is. He had two daughters, two son-in-laws, grandkids up north that he wanted to go home to. So his family, daughters and their spouses, were going to fly to Tampa, rent an RV, and then drive him up to Maine. Okay, I thought that was a great idea. Well, the team did not want him discharged. So there were the one obstacle that seemed to be the most was his liquid oxygen. I finally had to change him. When I first started seeing him, he was on a concentrator, an oxygen concentrator. And if anyone's familiar with them, they're about the size of a luggage, and it plugs into the wall, and it makes oxygen out of room air. And that's what he was on. He really needed liquid oxygen. So I had him changed out to liquid oxygen. And over the next few weeks, there was even one day I drove up, and he and his wife were sitting outside. His wife had managed to move the cannula cord through the window, threaded outside to a chair that he was sitting in. And when I drove up, he had this neon shirt on, pink socks, and he looked wonderful just sitting out in the sun. I mean, just like night and day from, you know, 6 weeks earlier when I saw him, met him. So, anyways, he was going to go up north. The team didn't want him up north, didn't want him leaving. And I asked the team, I said, please, let's get, you know, like a AAA ticket so they know how to go. And then there was a nor'easter coming in on the eastern seaboard that they would be driving through. So I asked for a AAA ticket. I asked for them to contact the liquid oxygen supplier about getting oxygen on the RV and his medications for him to take with him. Nobody wanted to do anything. The social worker, you know, didn't know how to get a AAA ticket. The nurse manager said no to the liquid oxygen. The doctor told him, just take the pill bottles. He doesn't need a prescription, just take the pill bottles. I mean, it was like pulling teeth trying to get anyone on that team to help this man to go back home, because it wasn't going to benefit the hospice for them to help this patient. It was only going to be to their detriment, so to speak, if he left. Because they want, I hate to sound so harsh, but they want that death on their record. That's what they want. They want you to see. Mm-hmm. This particular case with him, they want that death on that record because they knew he was getting close to the end here. Unlike Miss Minnie, let me go back to Miss Minnie again. Miss Minnie, even though she started using, she wasn't close to death. I mean, she still had a good 6 to 9 months left of her life. So it was behooving to the hospice to discharge her. But in Mr. L's case, they knew, you know, by his disease process, he didn't have long to live, maybe 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks. So they didn't want him to leave. And the nurse at one point even came out and told him that he's too fragile to leave. And I said, later I told that nurse, yes, he is fragile, but if he can sit on the side of his bed in his RV and can sit on the side of the bed in the RV that's moving, I mean, there's no difference,
mm-hmm.
one or the other. And the thing that gets me the most, well, there's two things. The social worker who did not know how to get the AAA tick, triptych, which visit the AAA office, call them, visit their website. I mean, there's numerous ways. If you, AAA.
Right.
Okay. That social worker came back and said, because I finally had to go to the liquid oxygen vendor myself and ask them to put a canister on the in the RV for the patient. That social worker said that it was illegal to put liquid oxygen in a vehicle. And no. So right at that moment, the team saw that as a complete roadblock. I mean, everything came to a stop, not like anything was moving before, but now they weren't even going to do anything for this patient. It took me almost a day of calling around to different agencies to find out, you know, liquid oxygen, because me just telling them that that was okay wasn't going to be enough. I needed, you know, documentation of some sort. Finally, I found somebody that would tell me liquid oxygen in a vehicle moving across multiple state lines at the amount that we that was going to be transported was nowhere near anything that anyone would be concerned about. That social worker knew, but he put that out there just as a roadblock. I'm sorry, I got lost in that.
But she put it as a roadblock, but you were able to circumvent that and find out that that wasn't true, that having liquid oxygen was not going to be an issue because you're taking the
right
time, whereas they just didn't want to be bothered with it. They didn't want to lose him.
Mm-mm. No. And my concern towards him when, you know, basically I will tell you, it was his one son-in-law that really made the difference to get that gentleman up, back up to where he was. They were determined, come hell or high water, they were going to put him, Mr. L, in that RV, and they were going to take him. And I even said that in an email to the entire team, that they are going to take him. We need to help them to the best of our abilities. That's what we're supposed to be doing. Nothing. Crickets.
Correct.
Crickets came back. And he did. He did make it up there, and it was about 4 weeks later that he passed home with his family at his bedside. the son-in-law called me the day after he passed to let me know, you know, that he had passed, and they were very thankful. And that's one of those patients that it's like, why can't every, you know, the end is what is important. I know there was a lot of issues to get him to that end, but if I had to go through all those issues to make it to the end with that patient, I would do it with every one of my patients, because that is what we're supposed to be doing.
Right.
That's how the patient is supposed to end. And I say patient, but that person, that loved one, wants to be with their family or in their own home. And because when you don't feel good, where do you want to go? You want to be at home in bed. So
it's your final chapter, and it should be written the way you want it to be written, not somebody else's way.
Right. That's
absolutely
a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. So I'm watching our time here. Do you want to talk about Kevin, or do you want to talk about Mr. Spikler?
If
we have time, we'll do both, but you tell me.
Let me do Mr. Spikler, because he was pretty much the last straw
pivotal
for me with him.
Yeah, the last straw, the pivotal. Let me preface that by saying, because I did not know this, medication, can you talk about prescription medication and how you're supposed to keep it? Because this definitely hit home with me and my dad, because this is how my dad keeps his prescriptions. So can you talk about that?
Prescription medications are to be kept in their pill bottle that's given to you from the pharmacy. It has the name of the pharmacy, their number. It has your name. It has the prescription name. It has the amount and how often you're supposed to take it. A lot of patients, when they're at home, will move their pills into a pill minder, you know, those 7 days or 24 days, to make it easier for themselves. And they know what they're taking, you know, or someone's doing it for them. The caregiver puts their pills. Here's the problem with that. Don't ever leave your home with that pill minder. If you have to go someplace with your medication, take it in the pill bottle. And it serves, first of all, if you're in an accident and you have pills in a pill bottle, that's easily identified to you by your ID, right? And then they can call the pharmacy to find out who your doctor is, or there's a prescription, there's a prescriber on your pharmacy bottle, and they can get history for you on what other illnesses, in case you can't speak for yourself. So it serves a purpose in that way. The other thing is, if you keep them in a pill minder and you're in an accident, they don't know, are these your pills or are they for somebody else? And what are these pills? And how often are you taking them? You know, now they can look up the pills individually in a PDA, but that takes time. The other thing is, if you happen to be, say, pulled over for a traffic violation, and for whatever reason, officer who pulls you over sees these, and again, I'm not saying this for everyone, just sees these medications, or he may interpret it as drugs, as in street drugs, and if the person is a little acting suspiciously, now you've opened the gateway to this officer going down a road that shouldn't be going. And again, let me say this. I have the utmost respect for our law enforcement people. In this instance, and I'm going to go in, if you don't mind, I'm just going to go right into Mr. Spikler.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
Mr. Spikler, that was his, that's what happened with him. He was in his car coming home from the doctor's office. He had his pill minder there, his pills. He was pulled over. I do not know what he was pulled over for. He had COPD. He had lung cancer. And he ended up being arrested. For what, I don't know. And between the pills and how he was behaving, he was arrested. So they took him to jail. When now, once at jail, and he's now deteriorating because the stress of being arrested and all of this, he ends up in the emergency room. In the emergency room, they ended up putting him on a BiPAP, which is, it helps breathe for you. It's one step down from a ventilator. A ventilator will breathe for you, and it can breathe for you when you can't breathe for yourself. A BiPAP can breathe for you, but you have to initiate the breath. So he was put on a BiPAP to give him support his breathing, augment his breathing, and to give him extra oxygen. So now he's been without his, and part of the medication that was in his pill minder was morphine. So now we have opiates, not in a labeled container. So now he's in the ER, and he was referred to hospice. And this happened very quickly. Okay, so one day, yesterday, because this happened in a three-day period. Yesterday, he drove to the doctor's office. He's driving home. He was arrested. And then sometime during that night, he was transferred to the emergency room. He was put on a BiPAP. And then quickly, same day, referred to hospice. Hospice gave him all those, the usual song and dance routine of, we can take care of all of this for you. And the nurse admitted him into hospice. And the nurse knew Mr. Spikler could only come off the BiPAP for like 5 or 10 minutes before the alarms would go off on his monitor, showing that his heart rate was going up and his oxygen level was going down. So the nurse, after he admitted him into hospice, called for transport to the hospice house. And upon arrival of the medical transport team, and when I say medical transport team, these are not paramedics. These are basic medical type. He was transferred in an ambulance. I'm sorry. When they arrived, the nurse removed Mr. Spikler from the BiPAP without a doctor's order. The hospice doctor didn't give the order, and the hospital doctor did not give the order. The plan was just to transport him on a 2-liter nasal cannula. Now, you have this gentleman that his breathing has been augmented by a BiPAP unit and the extra oxygen. And you take him off of that and you place him on a 2-liter nasal cannula. That's basically like pulling the rug out from under him. I don't know what that nurse was thinking other than, oh, I've got another admission. But there was no more thought put into that admission than that there's another check in my little quota box. Mr. Spikler was put in an ambulance for a 30-minute ride to the hospice house without any medications at the hospital for pre-transport. No morphine to ease the breathing, nothing. So by the time he arrived at the hospice house, he transported him late in the day, almost into the night. There was an email sent to me about 6:30 that night that the hospice house was getting a patient and could I come see him the next morning. So the next morning when I got the email, I went over there. The night shift nurse at the hospice house was in tears over the treatment of this gentleman. And when I went in to see this gentleman, he now had a respiratory rate of 3 a minute. At that point, he was basically dead. I hate to say that, but he was dead.
I know this is hard for you. It's reliving it. And that was done because they didn't do the proper thing for this gentleman.
No, it was all, it was only for the benefit of the hospital getting him out and hospice getting that admission. That the way that man must have suffered on his ride from the hospital to the hospice house, it sickens me to think about what and how he was treated. That was the final straw for me. And I would write an internal ethics point on how Mr. Spikler was treated. And I wrote an email to my manager and the medical director telling them I would no longer participate in any end-of-life withdrawals, that the situation with him, this man, was the last. And in that, the ethics point I completed, I put the last line as that basically this man was killed for the sake of an admission. So my manager, when she received that, the feedback I received from her was that I should not have included the patient's name with that sentence, because if any outside agency requested that patient's chart, the compliance report would have been included and the message would have been, they would see that what I stated was basically kill the patient for the sake of an admission. So her message to me was that we can kill people, we just don't want others to know about it.
Exactly.
So then following that ethics point, the corporate clinical officer wanted me to meet with her. And I went on, at this point, I'm so angry with the organization, I don't trust any of them, that I sent her this 2-page memo, saying that I had little faith of what I say would matter, other than to satisfy the curiosity of their legal department to what extent I know and what I'm willing to say. And I went on to cite 15 items, ranging from patients being discharged home without equipment or medications to admission nurses filling their quota system and staff physicians signing capacity statements on patients. Physicians signing capacity statements on patients they have not assessed. How do you judge a patient's capacity if you do not assess them?
You couldn't. That.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Nurses forging signatures on doctors and nurse practitioner orders. There were just so many things. Physicians being allowed to stay on records as the patient's primary care physician when that physician never even comes into the facility to see the patient. That's illegal. The illegal part is that they allow those physicians to do that because they're the referral source. That's illegal.
So it's more money. They're getting money for that patient.
Not for that particular patient, but for future patients from the referrals that doctor would give the hospice. And the doctor that stays on his record, the private community doctor that stays on his record, will continue to get money because that's his patient. But he never even goes in to see the patient. See there? That's how that
mm-hmm.
works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what happened after you, we have 8 minutes. What happened after you told them all of this and you pointed out all of these discrepancies and illegal acts they had done? What happened?
So the chief clinical officer wanted me to meet with her. So I met with her. Now, I have already accused this company of killing a patient for the sake of an admission. Okay. So she started with my quotas, saying that the quota system. Well, first she started with she didn't know anything about Mr. Spikler. Okay. Well, she knew about Mr. Spikler when I wrote the ethics report, right? And she was the chief clinical officer over that for a couple of years now. So if you have an employee that has accused your organization of killing a patient, even if you didn't know about it then, you know about it now. Would you not ask me about it?
No. Well, definitely, but then I have morals, so.
Right.
But yeah, you're
no.
right. She did not care.
No, she didn't. She didn't want to hear about it. She didn't care. She didn't ask no, that wasn't her concern. Her concern was my stating that the nurses have a quota to fulfill. And, yes, they do. We were having a back and to about how the patients are treated, and her view of how the patients are treated were much different than my view of what the patients were being treated. And she said she knew exactly how the patients were being treated because she was in meetings all day, every day, talking about such care. Okay. Well, I don't know that there's any patients in your board meeting. So I don't know how you know what's really going on when you're in a board meeting and I'm at bedside. I can tell you what's going on. And she said she can read a chart and know exactly what happened. No, you don't know exactly what happened. You know what somebody wants you to think happened. And it was, I can even feel my blood pressure going up right now. It was right now when she said that to me, that she can read a chart and know exactly what's going on with the patient. I looked at her and told her, you must be delusional. And that actually came out of my mouth before I even realized I had said it. It was
right,
that's the truth. You
right,
if that's
right.
what you think, then you
so
are delusional.
What what did she do? And I don't mean to be rushing you, but we're going to get cut off here. So what did she do after you told her you were delusional and after you had explained everything? What what happened then? What was the bottom line that they did?
Nothing for another week. And then I was terminated on, and the reason they decided I was terminated was because I worked on my day off a month ago. And yes, I did work on my day off. And the day that I couldn't clock in and out because I was out in the field. So I was driving all this time. We had a new employee working, and she needed help, and I was helping her and another physician via the phone. And I called my manager the next day and told her, please add 3 hours to my timesheet because I worked yesterday helping out so-and-so. And she even thanked me. So they fired me because I worked on my day off.
Wow. And you know that's not why they fired you. That was just an excuse.
No.
So did you go to anybody, talk to anybody about whistleblowing and retaliation?
I did. And if anyone knows about the federal government and anything like that, it takes years for these things to kind of fall out if they're not in the news. So, yes, that I have addressed it, and that's all I want to say about that.
Right.
I do want to back up really quick, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
Here is how hospice, and this is what, if anybody still chooses to use hospice after listening to this, how hospice has the upper hand when things go wrong. They're very good at documentation. The old rules goes, if it's not documented, it's not done. Well, they're very good at documenting. So when families say, you know, this happened, this happened, this happened, and then they ask, well, who, when, where? Well, I don't know. It was one of them. It was. The families have to be as good at documenting as the provider, whether it's hospice or anybody else. That
could
help a lot, too.
Good point. You should actually have, well, to begin with, if you don't put your person in hospice, then, yeah, that's part of the battle. But you're absolutely right. You should have a folder, a binder, who said what, when did they say it, what nurse, what time, you know, get
exactly.
Your medical records while your person is in the facility. You can request the medical records while they're there so you know what drugs are being given. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't have somebody to stand up and protect them.
Exactly. But, yep.
Yeah, and we needed more of you there to help do that. So let me see real quick because we had a couple of questions that people had put in. Was anyone held accountable for any of the instances of mistakes, noncompliance, or medical harm? And I believe the answer to that was no, because they didn't care. The result of whistleblowing, which you just told us, that's kind of still up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Nurse, you worked for one hospice, but they went across 7 different counties.
It was 3 hospices that was owned by, but they all had their own policies and stuff.
Okay. And so one of the group members wanted to make sure that you knew we're very grateful for your bravery in coming forward and warning the public. And there was one question about AFib. If you go into the hospital with breathing issues, should they be given large doses of morphine and albuterol for days, tied to a bed with a BPAP mask? They gave her 4 doses of albuterol. And a RT came in and refused to give her more and said that she had already been given too much.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on that one. Just out
okay.
Of, I'm not familiar with
you weren't there, so you don't really
know.
Gotcha.
Right,
understand.
Right.
So is there anything else that you want to add?
I would just encourage those that, you know, to write a letter to your legislature about the certificate of needs, the oversight of a hospice, and it's not, they need direct oversight, not more regulation, but direct oversight. Go ahead.
and they need a hammer, a stick, to do actually do
right.
something. If hospice is out of line, then they need to come down and actually monitor and do quality control instead of just talking about doing it. They need to actually do it.
Exactly.
So, well, thank
exactly.
you so much for coming on again. I appreciate it, and I'm glad Twisting Arms worked. So, thank you.
You're a doll, Marcia. Thank
okay.
you so very much. Thank
oh,
you.
You're welcome. All right, talk to you later. Okay, bye-bye.